Welcome to the Chief AI Officer Podcast,
where AI meets leadership.
And here is your host, Sanjay Puri.
Welcome to the CAIO Podcast, where we delve deep into the world of Chief AI Officers, exploring their journeys, insights, and challenges in steering AI initiatives within their organizations. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri. And today we are honored to have the pleasure of speaking with Beth Linker, Senior Director of Product Management for AI and SAST at Synopsys Software Integrity Group. Synopsys is the world's largest provider of application security software, and Beth's team is at the forefront of the AI initiatives. Join us as we uncover the secrets to Beth's success, the obstacles faced, and the wisdom gained along the way. Beth, thank you for joining us today. For our listeners who may be unfamiliar with your work, could you please share a brief overview of what Synopsys is, your role at Synopsys, and the AI initiatives you're leading?
Thanks, Sanjay. I'm really glad to be here. So Synopsys is the largest provider of semiconductor design technology. That's what most of our business is. But we also have a business unit, Software Integrity Group, that is devoted, as you mentioned, to application security, helping companies all over the world make their software and their software development processes more secure. And so that's what my team is focused on. And last year, in addition to running one of our product lines, I took on responsibility for artificial intelligence initiatives across our entire product portfolio, which includes many different kinds of application security, scanning, and testing solutions.
Wonderful. Beth, as I had mentioned to you before the podcast, that our podcast is global. We have a vast audience of AI experts, CEOs of companies, your colleagues, etc. And we're really thankful for having you on board. And the three main purposes of the podcast are to inspire others who want to follow in your footsteps, attract folks who might not know of the cool things you're doing. And then it's also collaboration with others who you can learn from and who can learn from you. So let's begin the inspiring others who want to follow in your journey. Tell them as to what inspired you to get into technology and AI.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been in technology for a long time now. I actually started my journey during the second AI winter, so a period where business enthusiasm for AI was at an all-time low. And a lot of the cool stuff that people are doing today wasn't really on the horizon. You know, if I look back to the mid to late 90s, you know, the things people were excited about were internet applications, e-commerce was just getting off the ground. So AI wasn't a big focal point for me early in my career. And I had a lot of experience working with technologies that were not quite ready for prime time. So doing things like mobile application development and smart home automation before the market had hit real critical mass. After working as a software developer for a while, I got into product and really found my passion of building great products for enterprise technology teams. And I've worked on web platforms, cybersecurity, compliance, and today really focused on application security in my work at Synopsys. And so AI, you know, had really always been an interest and something that I kept up with. But, you know, if you had asked me 5 years ago, how do you see your career and AI intersecting, I probably would have said, you know, that's not really sort of where my day-to-day is. And, you know, I think one of the key things that I've seen and learned in my career is to always be open to change and thinking about the future. And so when the current wave of generative AI adoption started to pick up speed, as it started to become a hotter topic all over the place, not just in tech circles, but, you know, even conversations with people who don't work in tech, everybody is feeling the impact of this technology. And, you know, I started looking and thinking, well, what does this mean for my business, my products, my customers, and the teams they work with? And it was really clear pretty early on that this is something that's hugely impactful for the world of software development. And so, you know, I started kind of reading a bit more, trying to keep up with things, taking in as much information as I could from a lot of different sources, trying to get some hands-on experience with some things. In that process, started to learn a lot and started to also kind of form a perspective on where I felt like my team and our company needed to go. And so got involved in some AI strategy initiatives that were being driven by one of our senior executives, and just kind of volunteered my way into my current role. So, you know, it's really, I think, about pursuing your interests, keeping an open mind, and being willing to say, hey, you know, I'll give this a try. This is something that I'm really interested in.
Now, that's fantastic. So for our listeners who are saying, hey, I want to be like Beth, keep an open mind. Tell our listeners just briefly, what is your typical workday like?
So the thing that I love most about my job is the variety of it. So there isn't really a typical day. There is a lot of different stuff. So, you know, if I look at today, for example, I've had a couple of calls with customers. I've had a few internal calls with teams about projects that we're working on. I've done a bit of networking inside the company. One of the things that is great about working on something that so many people are interested in is that, you know, a lot of people in different pockets of the organization have reached out to say, hey, what are you doing? I have ideas. How can we work together? And we're a company that has grown over the last decade through a lot of different acquisitions, which means we have a lot of different pockets of capabilities. And part of what I do is really about building connections, bridging gaps between different groups, and helping people learn how to work together. So, you know, I have a lot of conversations with people where they're curious about what I'm doing, what the team is doing, and they've got ideas, things they want to try. And so one of the things that's been really important to our ability to add more AI to what we're doing in our products has been really working on our innovation muscles. So large organizations with established products, it's not always easy to try new things, to experiment. The most successful organizations find ways to get good at that. And we've been fortunate that with great sponsorship from our leadership, we've been able to create some structures that give people ways to propose ideas, to experiment, to try things out. And I think that's been really critical for us in terms of our ability to innovate with AI.
So basically, a typical workday is going to be a non-typical workday because anything can happen. It can be customer interface. It can be sometimes networking. As you said, that becomes an important aspect, the executive communication, because this is getting a lot of visibility in there. So for our listeners, it's really important to know that Beth is balancing many different stakeholders. Beth, what are the main challenges and opportunities that you have dealt with as you built this or are building this AI ecosystems within Synopsys?
Great question. I think the biggest challenge is focus. So there is so much going on in the world of AI and a lot going on, you know, across all of our product lines. And so some of our initial brainstorms, you know, we had dozens of ideas, things to explore, things we wanted to try, and you can't do all of it at once. And so we had to sort of say, okay, what are the things that we want to do first? What kind of timing do we want to strive for on those? What are some of the things that we want to take a little bit more time to explore? And how do we balance that? How do you say no to some ideas that people might be very excited about? Or not right now, but maybe we'll come back to that. And so I think a big challenge has been putting together a coherent story about what we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it, and making sure that we were focusing in the right places. And that's something that you really do through repetition. So, you know, starting months ago, we had a story about what we were seeing in the market, what we were doing, and just continuing to refine that. You know, every time I talked to someone, I'd come away with a little bit of refinement. We do a lot of user groups around the world with our customers. And so I've had the opportunity to be one of the featured speakers at those events. And so every few months, going to a different city, having the opportunity to put our AI vision and ideas in front of a group of customers, see what kind of feedback comes out of that. In some cases, you know, customers have really contributed product ideas for us. They've said, hey, you know, it'd be great if you did this. And we've been able to go and try it. And in other cases, it's really, you know, you float a few balloons and you see which ones catch some air. So it's really that repetition, telling a story over and over to different audiences and taking their feedback and using it to refine and just continue to get more focused.
So focus, I think, Beth, is something that you talked about as a challenge and opportunity also, in the sense there's so much happening and it's hard to stay focused, but then you're out there with different audiences taking feedback and then applying them. Beth, as the people who are looking at you and say, hey, how do I get to be in that role? What are your thoughts on the role of mentorship? Have you had success with that? And what would you say to our audience in terms of should they look for a mentor? What kind of mentor?
So I think everybody should always be open to mentorship. And mentoring can come in a lot of different ways. I'm someone who personally, I do a lot of mentoring. I've had mentees who were kind of people I talked to once a month, sometimes long-term, sometimes, you know, for like a six-month period. I've also done a lot of one-off mentoring where, you know, I've had a conversation with someone, maybe helped them with a resume or structuring their story to pursue a job. And it's something that I find really rewarding as a way to give back, to help people, and also to get some exposure to the world outside of my job and my company and my office. So I always encourage people to get involved in mentoring, really on both sides. And I've been fortunate to have a really diverse group of mentors, some of them official, some of them not official, some of them just people who I could walk into their office or say, hey, do you have time for a quick Zoom call? And they would be really generous and make time for me. And that's something that, you know, I really try to do as much as I can for everybody I encounter in my current role.
So mentoring is very important. Beth's perspective is that mentors come in many different forms, reach out. Beth does a lot of mentoring with mentees, you know, Zoom calls, etc. But reach out to mentors because they do play a huge, huge role. And I think that those are great, great perspectives. Beth, talking about letting our listeners know some of the cool things that are happening within Synopsys, let's jump a little bit to that. How is AI being incorporated in Synopsys' SaaS offerings like Coverity and Polaris Fast Static? Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
So you've caught us at a pretty exciting time. We've just announced this week the launch of Polaris Assist, which is our new AI capability for static analysis on the Polaris platform. So this is a great example of taking a specific problem and applying AI to address it. So if you think about our core audience, it's organizations who are using our tools to detect security issues in their software products. And so once you detect those issues, somebody has to go investigate them and remediate them. And this is really one of the hardest challenges in cybersecurity. So if you think about an application security team with maybe 4 or 5 people, they're going to be responsible for serving the application security needs of hundreds, even a few thousand developers. The ratios there are extreme. And so the challenge then becomes most software developers are not security experts. They have a lot of other stuff that they're trying to do. Everybody wants to do a good job on security, but the reality is that the expertise isn't always there. And it can be really hard to find and understand security issues in your own code. You're a little bit too close to it in a lot of cases. And so the challenge is, you know, you can produce a set of findings, you can produce a report, you can feed that data into a place where developers are able to look at it. And then they have to sit down and do something with that list. And this is where we saw the opportunity to apply artificial intelligence. Because if you look at the things that generative AI is really good at, it is really good at summarizing information. And so that was a capability that we wanted to take advantage of. And it's also, large language models do generally very well working with source code. They get trained on a lot of source code and source code related data. We saw through some of the trials that Synopsys was doing internally with AI coding assistant tools that they were able to provide useful suggestions to developers across a wide variety of languages. And we said, you know, how do we take these capabilities plus the information that we've got? And we have a lot of information. And I think one of the mistakes that companies, products like ours, have made historically is to give developers too much information. Because as a developer, if you give me a page of stuff to read and some footnotes to learn more, maybe a video that I can watch to learn about a particular security issue, okay, that's a lot of information to take in. And then I need to distill it down and figure out, okay, how does this apply to exactly what I'm doing right here? And so we said, you know, what if we use generative AI plus all the information that we've got, and we use that to construct an intentionally very concise summary that says, here's the problem, here's what your code is doing, here's where it goes wrong, and potentially even suggest, here's how you could fix it. So providing specific fixes. So we've gone from, here's a lot of general information about this class of problem, to here's something that's targeted and actionable about your specific problem. And so we're in the process of rolling that out. We're very excited. Customers have been extremely interested. And just like anything else in this space, we know that, you know, the first version is just the beginning, but we are really excited to have that capability out there now.
That's very exciting, Beth. So, Beth, just as a follow-on question for either potential clients, potential employees, etc., are you customizing your own LLM? Is that what you're doing?
So in this specific case, we're not. And that's something that we thought about. It's an approach that some folks in the industry have taken. And there were really two things that kept us from going down that particular route. The first was the pace of large language model innovation right now is very fast. And so when I looked at you know, the team, the resources we had to do that kind of customization. And I compared that to what was happening in the industry. I said, you know, I think the best thing for us would be to set ourselves up to adopt new advances as fast as they come out. That seemed like the winning strategy for us. And it has been. We actually had a situation where we needed to switch models pretty much overnight. And we were able to do that because we didn't have a lot of customization that needed to be brought along. So that gives us a number of different kinds of flexibility. The other thing that it does for us, which is, I think, an important thing for our customers, is because we work with source code, which is highly sensitive intellectual property, we knew that some of our customers would not be comfortable, especially our customers who run our tools on-premise instead of through software as a service. We knew that some folks were going to say, you know what, I don't want that code going to a large language model that I don't control. So for some folks, you know, you say, okay, these are the controls we have in place. We're never going to use your data for training. You've got these assurances. For some people, that's great and they're happy. For others, that's not enough. And so we've talked to a lot of customers about their needs around large language model security and privacy. And so we wanted to also leave the door open for customers to provide their own LLM instances to be used with our application. And so that is something that we are going to be able to offer. It's not something we're doing yet, but it's an important component of our roadmap to give customers that flexibility and choice. So one of the things that we're thinking about in our roadmap is how to give customers a choice between using a large language model that we provide versus providing their own, whether that's an endpoint from a major vendor or something that's entirely on-premise for them. So that flexibility in customer choice is really important for us.
So some very important points that you made, especially for our listeners, and this is one of the questions that came in from a potential listener, is what is your or Synopsys' philosophy of open source versus closed source LLMs? Are you using any open source, Beth?
So that's a great question. In general, we are enormous fans of open source. Supporting the open source community is a big part of what we do. We run free versions of several of our products that are available specifically to open source projects to support them. So we're very much pro open source. For the projects that we're doing right now, we are working primarily with commercial models, but again, it's a matter of the right tool for the job and thinking about how we are going not just to use it to build the product, but also the long-term supportability.
Okay. Beth, talk about, just some of the ways that you ensure diversity and inclusion within your team, and why is it important for driving innovation as people are looking at Synopsys for a place to come to?
Absolutely. I think, so the research on diversity really speaks for itself. Diverse teams are high-performing teams and vice versa. And for me, what that's really meant in terms of building my team, and I'm not talking just about my direct reports, but the web of collaborators who we rely on throughout the organization, a lot of it comes down to openness and encouraging everybody who expresses an interest to check out what we're doing and get involved. And I think that that is a really important part of our success, is giving lots of different people and teams the ability to get involved and to contribute. Synopsys overall does a ton of great stuff around diversity. We've got some explicit goals to improve the diversity of especially our technical teams. And I'm fortunate to work with just an incredible group of people from all walks of life and all over the world. And I think one of the great things about tech historically has been the way in which you have not needed a specific academic background or pedigree to get a job in tech. Some of the most amazing people I've hired or worked with didn't have the opportunity to go to college and still managed to make amazing careers for themselves in tech. And I think that openness to saying, you know, it doesn't matter if you went to a specific school, it doesn't matter if you have a specific credential, it's really about what can you do and how much are you willing to dig in and to learn new things, you know, going back to openness, which we've talked about. I think that when people are open to learning and trying new things, you can get a lot done. So that's how I look at it when it comes to recruiting people for the initiatives that I'm driving and building teams and webs of collaboration.
That's fantastic. Beth, another question was about a culture of innovation is there. How do you foster that culture of innovation and experimentation within your group?
So, like I was saying earlier, I think that this is a big challenge in large organizations with very successful product portfolios like we're fortunate to have. There is a lot of incentive to keep doing what works and to not get too crazy trying new things. And so when you want to innovate, the challenge becomes, how do we create space for innovation? How do we create ways in which someone who has an idea can get some resources to try it out, to explore? And so one of the things that we've done that's really fantastic is we've got a great hackathon culture. Twice a year, teams take a week to do whatever they want to do. And something that we did starting about a year ago that has been really great is, rather than just saying, okay, the engineers are off doing whatever they want to do for the hackathons, we got the product team involved, and we've been able to designate specific themes where we're not telling people what to do. We're just saying, hey, here's a theme, a broad area that's really interesting to the business, and we would love to see your ideas. And then we give out some prizes judged by the product team for some of the top ideas. So generative AI was actually the second theme that we did in that fashion. And so we got some great ideas. People tried some stuff out. Some of it has turned into product experiments that we're doing right now. So that's one thing that we've done. I talked a little bit about our innovation lab. So that's something where anybody can submit an idea, and we've got folks who will work with them to get that to a proof of concept. We've got some other stuff that we're working on right now to try and make some of that a bit more interactive with our customers. So it's an ongoing process, but it's really about, again, just trying to give people as much opportunity as possible.
Well, that's great. So you have hackathons, you have innovation labs. So being focused, but still having innovation happening. Beth, you touched earlier, but maybe you can just be a little more specific about the upskilling that you offer your employees, because that's something they're interested in. What would be the opportunities for upskilling and reskilling for some of these people?
Yeah, we have a lot of great opportunities for skills development, including, you know, the things that you see at many corporations. So tuition benefits, we've got folks who've gone and gotten degrees with company sponsorship. We've also got a lot of great online learning resources. So if you want to go learn about something, take courses online. We've got hundreds of different things you can do for free. So a lot of great opportunities there. And then, you know, really trying to give people opportunities to learn by doing. So one of the things that I saw when I took on my current role was nobody was telling me, okay, go out and hire a bunch of people. It was more, hey, you know, what can we do with the team that we've got? And so that meant giving people a lot of opportunities to try doing things. And, you know, we recently had the opportunity to send one of my team members and some of our developers to do some training together. So, you know, we're doing a lot of different things to help people develop the skills that they need. We do a lot of knowledge sharing internally. And I think that with the demand for skills in this area, there just aren't enough people to hire out there. And the thing that is really important when it comes to AI is for most companies like ours, it's not so much that you need a big injection of pure AI skills. You need people who've got AI skills who really understand your business. And so the thing that, yeah, the big strength that we have is just tremendous knowledge and understanding of our business with folks who've been doing this for a long time. And so when you take those folks and you give them access to AI tools and you start to build systems where they can try things, and you combine that with the data you've got, that's where the magic starts to happen.
That's fantastic. So a lot of opportunities for internal reskilling, for upskilling. That's awesome. You know, talking a little bit about, you know, collaboration, learning, and others learning from your peers learning from you. How do you ensure the responsible and ethical development of some of these AI technologies, Beth?
So that's a great question. It's something that's personally important to me, and I think important to everybody that I work with. We all want to do the right thing. And it really comes down to having a solid governance process. So Synopsys at the corporate level has an AI governance process. And so when we're going to launch something, there's a process we have to go through where we have to really show our work and ensure that we are doing the right things with our application, with the data that we're working with. And, you know, we're working with application security use cases. It's important that the information we provide be accurate, that we be really clear about which content we show is AI generated. And it's also important that we're protecting customers' IP and privacy. So a lot of it comes down to transparency, giving people the ability to opt in to using these features at the right level of the organization. So we've got a great governance process that helps us keep on track. But we're thinking about this really through every stage of the design process, talking to customers about what they would consider acceptable, and just trying to do the right thing at every step of the way. But I think this is, you know, absolutely something that everybody who's working with this technology needs to be thinking about.
So, as you said, it's a top priority. Does Synopsys have an ethics committee or an ethics board, Beth?
We do.
Okay, great. That's excellent. You talked a little bit about how there is a lot of focus on what you do from, you know, the executives, etc. How do you collaborate with other leaders to make sure there is a, you know, a cohesive enterprise-wide AI strategy within the company?
So I think a lot of it, again, comes back to just consistently sharing what we're doing, sharing at every step of the way. I'm a big proponent of putting stuff out there before it's perfect necessarily to get as much feedback and refinement as you can. I think that where people run into trouble is often where you spend too much time polishing something, get too attached to it, and then struggle to absorb feedback and potentially criticism or redirection. And so keeping an open mind, inviting as much feedback as possible, getting in front of people as often as possible. We've got a number of things that we do within our organization to share roadmaps very frequently, share updates. We do biweekly status reviews where we let people know what's going on. So we have a lot of venues to get the word out about what we're doing and really just continually invite feedback and discussion. So, you know, really anybody who is willing to hear about what we're doing, we've been happy to share it, and just continuing to stay open to feedback and also stay abreast of what other teams are doing. So nobody works in a vacuum. It's very important to understand what other teams are doing, what they're seeing, what their priorities are. And that's often where ideas come from, you know, hearing that something is becoming really important to a product line can sometimes jumpstart a line of thinking about a way that we could attack a problem with AI, for example.
Well, that's great. So a lot of communications, get a lot of feedback, then act upon that feedback. That's great. Beth, how do you assess the business impact and ROI of your AI programs?
That's a great question. And I'd say we're still early in that process. And especially when you're adding features or capabilities to a product, you may not be able to get a clear read on, well, how much did my feature impact someone's decision to buy or not to buy? So you have to get comfortable working with some anecdotal feedback, as well as looking at what's happening with the actual numbers. So a lot of what we're doing is focused on measuring usage. So usage and adoption, are people trying this? Do they like it? Do they keep using it? Those are really the numbers that we're focused on.
Usage and adoption, two great metrics, Beth, for your success. Beth, how important is to for an organization to have a strong data science team for the successful AI adoption?
So my data science leader would be very upset with me if I said it wasn't tremendously important, but he's right. So I'm fortunate to work with an amazing data science team. And I think that the biggest asset that companies like ours as users of AI bring to the table is our data. And it's very easy to dream up things that you might be able to do with AI, but if you don't have data and if you don't have any way of measuring whether your machine learning got it right, then you're not going to get very far. So we use data and the ability to measure whether you're getting the right answer as filters for, you know, a lot of brainstorming and ideation. Okay, well, do we have any data that we could use to do that? If we do, great. That's something we might be able to move on. And if we don't, then maybe we need to look at where we might get that data. And I think one of the exciting things about generative AI is that it has the potential to help us use data in new and creative ways to solve some of the long-term challenges in our space. So that's something that I'm really excited about. But pragmatically, it only works if you can get the data and if you can make sense of it appropriately. And that's where the data science team is absolutely indispensable. So they're one of our key partners for sure.
So data is very important. Kudos to your colleague and who's running the data science team who will be listening to this podcast. You were talking about new sources of data. Just briefly, wanted to touch synthetic data?
Not necessarily synthetic, but thinking long term, there's structured data and unstructured data. And a lot of times, some of the information that would be useful for really making better determinations is buried in unstructured data or data that is harder to integrate into our workflows. And I think that generative AI, with the ability to parse and interpret some of that data, has a lot of potential to help us get better results for our customers. One big area that we've been exploring is, as I mentioned, our customers use our tools to work on their proprietary source code, which is understandably top secret. And so some of the things that we do to ensure better interoperability with, say, popular open source code libraries that lots of people use. Now, if you've got a library that's widely used inside your company, but it's not public, historically, we haven't been able to work with that really well. But if we've got generative AI that can, quote unquote, read it without a human ever having to see it, that creates some interesting new opportunities. So we're looking at a lot of cases where automating things that have historically required a lot of reading is an intriguing possibility.
Wow. Some very fascinating aspects of data sources. But given the nature of your business, Beth, you had an amazing journey. What are some of the key lessons you've learned in this journey? And what advice would you give to organizations who are trying to, you know, establish a chief AI officer role or leader as they build out their AI capabilities?
For me, it's really about openness and a sense of adventure. You know, this is a challenge that I took on because I was really excited about it and wanted to see where it would go. It's not been predictable. It's been a lot of fun, but it continues to be, hey, let's see what's around the next curve. So I think that for individuals who are thinking about being change agents within their organizations, trying to help the organization do something that it's not doing widely today, having that sense of adventure and openness to possibilities is super important. And I think for organizations, change is hard. Driving change and trying new things and experimentation in a large organization is not easy. And so it's not just something where you tap someone on the shoulder and say, you're very smart, go figure it out. It's really important to think about, how are you going to support that person and set them up to be able to make things happen? And so, you know, for somebody who's stepping into a role leading AI efforts, you know, within a team, within a business unit, within an entire company, understanding those support structures and how you're going to get the organization to work with you is super important.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Beth, as we come to the end of our podcast, and I have so many other questions, we'd need to bring you back. We do a quick lightning round of questions, just one or two or three sentence answers if you want for our listeners. Cloud-based AI or on-prem AI?
Whatever meets the organization's needs.
Very good. Any thoughts on long-term implications of AGI and its impact on society, Beth?
It's going to be interesting.
It definitely is going to be very interesting. This concludes our very insightful conversation with Beth. You know, from your journey to sharing such invaluable insights through the challenges and opportunities in AI implementation, Beth, you provided us with a wealth of knowledge, and we really are grateful for the time that you've taken, and really wish you all the success in the future of AI at Synopsys. And your leadership and vision is definitely going to inspire others to pursue their careers. And thank you to all our listeners for tuning into the CAIO podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the leaders who are driving AI innovation forward. So stay tuned for captivating conversations with chief AI officers from across industries. Thank you so much, Beth, for taking the time. This has been fabulous.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.